This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Good Clean Fun, Misadventures in Sawdust at Offerman Woodshop. This is the author, Nick Offerman. To Shozo Sato, my sensei. To Lee, my hero. To Megan, my lignum vitae. Introduction. Howdy, neighbor. Here comes a mellifluous collection of audio files chock full of woodworking mirth and knowledge. In this brawny tome from the fine folks at Penguin Random House Audio, you will be treated to 1. Many words from me, as well as some phrases, with maybe even a diatribe or two, on the topic of woodworking. 2. Tomfoolery, also known as grab-ass. As in any good shop or shop book, we also take the occasional break for some ribaldry, which means irreverent behavior, which means fun. 3. A couple of how-to chapters, including a pop-tops bottle opener and a three-legged stool, which I will walk you through in a very gentle fashion. All right, we have a long row to hoe, so let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. You seem pretty sharp, so you probably gleaned that my name is Nick Offerman, and I am the author of this quality piece of bookery, as well as the proprietor of Offerman Woodshop in Los Angeles, California, where most of the book's action will be set. I also often work as an actor on stage, screen, and television, and am perhaps best known for my role as Ron Swanson on NBC's Parks and Recreation, a fine comedy program that I can recommend for your downtime from the shop. That is, if you have run out of books to listen to. Ron had a large mustache and complicated relationships with his two ex-wives, both named Tammy, and the audience seemed to respond to him in a generally favorable fashion, to my great relief. What's more, I tour as a humorist, and I have a comedy special on the channels and whatnot, entitled American Ham. They probably put some of this on the copy that came with your download, but if you'll excuse me, I'll cover my own fanny here, because you never can tell about what exactly these book-selling types think they should use to market a book in this bleak modern landscape of electronic tablets and delivery by drone and what have you. If you're listening to this on some sort of gadget, fine, but please do not hold me accountable for the deleterious effects of sawdust and linseed oil upon your newfangled gewgaw. Why am I writing this book now, you may ask? Because woodworking is one of the great passions in my life. The others are, of course, my wife, my family, my friends, our dogs, music, cheese curds, the great outdoors, bacon, eggs, my bride, the Chicago Cubs, puzzles, beef Wellington, the theater, my canoe, my wife, Wilco, and single malt Scotch whiskey. Some of those topics may be touched upon briefly in the upcoming chapters, but we'll mainly be focusing upon woodworking. Welcome. It occurs to me to lay out a quick synopsis of my own history with tools by way of illustrating the point that there are many wonderful things that can be done with wood and tools that don't require the moniker of fine woodworking. We all start with building a treehouse of some sort, and then some of us are happy to just call it a day and hang out up there, a noble pursuit, no question, while others of us continue to work on building a better treehouse. We don't rest until we have hung sash windows in our treehouses, which then causes us to be labeled as troubled. That is, until it begins to rain and we can close the windows and keep our comic books from getting wet, at which point we are then considered gifted. Tool skills have certainly helped me earn a living over the years, But much more importantly, they've opened me up to a way of living, often in collaboration with other tool users, also known as artists, that has never stopped paying me dividends. My education began at a traditional American institution, an old farmhouse out on Bell Road in the southeastern corner of Kendall County, Illinois. And my teachers were no less than local superheroes, Mom and Dad. On our 3-acre plot, they were legendary for their ability to pull fresh turnips out of black garden soil, steaming loaves of bread from previously empty ovens, hand-sewn garments out of thin air, gravel from barked-up knees, and even smiles from tear-strewn faces. Mind you, they performed these feats of excellence whilst juggling 2 daughters, 1 regular son, and 1 exceptional son. One of the most exceptional smartasses, that is, that the Tri-County area had ever known. One of my absolute favorite series of novels was the Little House books of Laura Ingalls Wilder, in no small part because they reminded me so much of my own parents' resourcefulness. When these Bell Road super friends found the household wanting some necessary implement or accessory, they taught my siblings and me that there was a quicker and cheaper way to acquire things than shopping for them. One could make things. "Dad, where'd that grape arbor come from?" "I built it." "Get out of here." "Okay, son, but I did." "Well, sweet Peter, Paul, and Mary, can I do that?" My dad was always building something, it seemed to me, when he wasn't planting garlic or skunking us in a game of horse, so it would have stood to reason that he grew up amongst carpenters of yore, raising barns before lunch and then installing staircases after. In fact, I later learned that he taught himself to build furniture by simply doing. For example, when my mother wanted a new bookshelf to hold reference books and photo albums, he just copied an antique oak china closet that was in a corner of the dining room. My mom has pointed out, though, that the first thing he built was born from a parenting need. I was the first son, therefore I was the first initiate in the household who needed training in the field of, technically speaking, peeing standing up. I had the inclination right, and my jaunty stance was satisfactory, not to mention my acumen for judging the wind trajectory, but still, faced with the modern lavatories of the early 1970s, there was the serious obstacle that I was too damn short. Undaunted, my dad built me a little wooden step from which I could show off my skills to any spectator interested in the fine arts of arc and stream. I grew up learning the use of tools from him, mainly, as well as from my uncles and grandfathers, but I want to come clean here and point out that I wasn't very good at it. They were generous and patient teachers, and so they would watch me attempt to swallow the digestible effects of their tutelage until they were satisfied I could merely use the given tool without injuring myself or the object I was fixing. For so many years, I would whack a nail with all my might, only for them to admonish me with a shouted, "Hit it!" Then they would stand, hands on hips, and wait for goodness knows what, as though I were about to be able to magically hit the nail harder because of the clarity of their instruction. "Oh, hit it! Okay, I didn't realize when I was hitting it just now that I was supposed to hit it." The thing is, however, I don't think young people are supposed to be all that good at work. Sure, there are some exceptions to the rule, egg suckers, brown nosers, and the like, but most of us kids were too busy thinking about fishing or baseball or Paula Abdul, or huffing glue and WD-40 for the future gourmands. The important thing was that they stuck by me in their teaching, despite our apparent differences in interpretation of the verb to hit. From their fidelity, I eventually gained a work ethic, by which I understood that if I kept trying to succeed at changing that truck tire, or mending those fence boards, or hitting that son of a biscuit nail, I eventually would succeed, and then, with further effort, I would succeed even more better than I had the last time. I would sink a nail with 1 easy hammer swing, finally, But by then, they would not praise me. They would have resumed their own work because I no longer needed chiding. I could now be trusted to drive a nail without supervision, which was better than any compliment. By the time I started theater school at age 17, I had become pretty darn medium with a hammer. I'd give my swing a 7 out of 10, maybe an 8, right after breakfast. I had worked a summer framing houses and also had done a lot of carpentry around our place with my dad, so I could hammer a nail with a decent confidence that I wouldn't leave more than one or two elephant tracks. But I was still young, a couple years away from filling out to my full strength, so I was a bit cautious when asked to hammer together some 2x4s in theater shop class. When I successfully, albeit slowly, buried some 16-penny sinkers into a floor platform's frame, I noticed the other kids in my class just staring at me with abject wonder. "How can you do that?" one ventured. "Huh. Interesting." On the framing crew, I was a kid laborer who was learning to swing his persuader like a grown-up, but in this classroom, I guess I was a veritable Thor. I ended up working in that estimable scenery shop for wages during my tenure of study at the University of Illinois, and my lifelong love of the woodshop was born. The man in charge, Ken Egan, ran a very tight ship, and among his lessons was the importance of keeping one's shop clean, organized, and tidy. They were producing a rolling repertory schedule of scenery for the three theaters in the building, so efficiency had to reign supreme. It was my first run-in with shop safety as well, learning the proper equipment and techniques to use around the massive milling machines and the treacherous table saw. Kenny Egan's training, as well as that of his crew, proved invaluable when I arrived in Chicago to make my own way in the world of professional theater. The skills I took away from his shop qualified me to be immediately hired as a professional scenic carpenter at a few different theaters where my education continued. This time, I was to learn how to achieve the construction of ambitious set designs without the benefit of a healthy college budget, or a healthy shop facility, for that matter. I recall one shop in the basement of an apartment building in Wicker Park. It's probably a coffee bean and tea leaf now, or an artisanal butter outlet, that had no ventilation other than the door, which worked okay unless it was 10 degrees below in a blizzard or simply sleeting to beat the band, one of Chicago's favorite weather conditions. The table saw didn't have enough infeed space to mount an 8-foot sheet of plywood flat, so one had to hold the sheet up at head height and curve it into the blade to start the cut, until a couple of feet had passed through and the plywood could be dropped to horizontal. Cowboy carpentry. Of course, adversity and necessity can be the cruel mothers of invention, so my fellow woodchucks and I learned tricky ways to achieve every task required of us, just maybe without utilizing the safest of methods. I would ask you not to mention it to the administration of the Wisdom Bridge Theater, but that venerable institution has long since folded, so the truth of our malfeasance can now be told. Hey, we made it pretty by opening night. That's the point, right? We'll look into being a stubborn idiot in a little more detail later in this recording. The main tools required of the scenic shop are ideally a table saw with a big outfeed table, a lot of sheet goods passed through that saw, a chop or miter saw, some cordless drills, and an air compressor with a couple of pneumatic, brad, or staple nailers. Eventually, a router becomes necessary, or at least right handy, for milling trim and doing edge work on floor platforms and such. Once I had collected this kit, some new, but mostly a hodgepodge of old used items, I was able to open my own little scenic concern in the very North Avenue warehouse where I was also hanging my hat. Running my own shop allowed me to work on scenery jobs for various little theaters, as well as build outside commissions like trade show sets and minor pieces for people's homes, like built-ins. The problem with paying a scenic carpenter to do lasting work in your home is that he or she is perhaps not so good at building it well, but is instead very good at imbuing the work with the facade of quality through any number of aesthetic tricks, usually involving toothpaste. So my work was pretty spotty at this point, but at least I was cheap. My clientele were mainly friends from the theater, so they were very understanding participants in my wood-based education. Around this time, at age 25 or so, something very important happened to me in regard to my journey with tools. My very good friend, Rob Eck, also known as Falcon Smoker, was an actor and fight choreographer who also paid the bills with roofing and light carpentry. While the framing skills of my youth didn't really translate smoothly to the scenery shop, his own youthful family training in roofing and carpentry had stuck with him in adulthood. Rob hired me to help him do some work at a recording studio, which included hanging a new door. As we prepared to install the knob and lock set, he pulled out a chisel and deftly mortised the door jamb for the deadbolt and strike plate, and I was gobsmacked. "How did you do that?" He showed me how sharp his chisel was and patiently explained how to use the flat side and the beveled side. I was slowly trying to shed my boyhood practice for a man's habits, and the example Rob set had really changed me. I had already recognized it as one worthy of emulating. He cooked a week's worth of stew and baked cornbread to stretch his paycheck, while we all blew ours on burritos, beer, and pizza. I knew that if I could get my hands on one of those sharp chisels and a bunch more of his brand of know-how, then I too could perform work upon wood that would last longer than the run of a play. In the late 1990s, I moved to Los Angeles and made a good deal of my living building decks and cabins for houses in the hills when I wasn't lucky enough to be working in films and TV. My bosom pal, Martin McClendon, and I took a lot of pride in the transition from building scenery, he's a top-drawer scenic designer, to building rugged structures, out in the elements, no less, that would last. As we were both new to Southern California, we were quite edified to discover the architecture and furniture work of Charles and Henry Green, commonly known as Green and Green. As a couple of the shining stars of the arts and crafts movement at the start of the 20th century, Green and Green elevated the exposed joinery of post and beam construction to a pinnacle of elegance and artistry. Marty and I immediately began to infuse our work with nods to their style, as well as that of their superstar contemporary, Frank Lloyd Wright. Their inspiration put us immediately on the scent of more complex and attractive joinery, a hunt that continues to this day. Before we knew it, while building a charmingly wacky timber frame yoga hutch in a friend's yard, we had become obsessed with woodworking. I acquired Jim Tolpin's essential book, Table Saw Magic, and we were completely blowing our labor budget by experimenting with sleds and jigs on our crappy contractor's saw because, by crikey, we were hooked. We had become woodworkers. Now, this transition can be identified by a couple of different chalks. And, of course, it's different for every girl and boy, but one way to confirm that the bug has been soundly caught is this. Your tolerance becomes laughably small. Let me take a moment to explain. When using a tape measure, the amount of acceptable deviation from the exact correct measurement is known as the tolerance. So when framing a house, for example, the tolerance was a quarter inch. Now I could cut you a dozen studs, and if they were within a quarter inch of too long or too short, it was acceptable, although frowned upon. In theater scenery, the tolerance was more like an eighth of an inch, depending on the application, and that seemed pretty small and persnickety at the time. Imagine my surprise, then, when I learned that the tape measure actually had regularly marked increments smaller than an eighth of an inch. Twice as small, in fact. In the woodworking shop, though, Those 16th-inch notations were even still too large a tolerance. When it comes to fitting joinery, a deviation of even a 64th of an inch can render a piece unacceptable. Hilarious, right? Over the next several years, I had the good fortune to create my own woodshop, which I creatively dubbed Offerman Woodshop, where I continue to build furniture commissions and explore the limits of my own clumsiness. Inspired by the likes of Gary Knox Bennett and George Nakashima, I began collecting slabs of trees from Northern California from which to construct trestle tables. I met Ted Moores of Bear Mountain Boats and built a few small watercraft. Eventually, as my clowning career began to pick up momentum in a healthy way, I realized that I would need some help at the shop if I wanted to keep the tools running, and so I began to seek out the members of our collective, which has evolved over the years into the current team of stalwarts, who I am proud to say have found marks on their fine starret measuring devices denoting 1/128th of an inch. I have to take their word for it. Whether you choose to pursue that level of precision or not, let's see if we can't get you making sawdust or shavings at some level. I want to briefly point out that I am not a master woodworker. I only say this because I have often been erroneously called as much by well-meaning members of the press corps, so let's clear up that misapprehension right here at the get-go. In my opinion, a master of any particular craft is a person who spends a good deal of her or his life devoted to the perfection of said craft, whether it's baking bread or raising livestock or building furniture. Within these very pages, in fact, besides learning about woodworking and my woodshop, we will also examine the lives and workshops of some contemporary heroes of mine, some women and men who have committed themselves to just such a mastery of discipline. I, in all likelihood, will never have the simple pleasure of such a life's devotion, as I too greatly enjoy my main pursuit of entertaining the folks who will have me. As long as I continue to be tolerated upon the stages or screens or bookshelves of the world, then woodworking will remain only one of my jobs. Now, that's not to say that I won't apply myself to a constant pursuit of betterment with every project. I most certainly will, as that's the whole point. Just please don't mistake me for a master. The point of this book is that working with wood can be fun and productive on every level, not just the most refined. As long as the working status of my hands remains intact, please let me remain a pupil. Which brings me to one of the most important adages of my life's philosophy: always maintain the attitude of a student. I was taught this in college by my kabuki theater sensei, Shozo Sato, and it has stuck with me tenaciously. Whenever I perform as a humorist, I encourage the audience to find something to make with their hands. It really doesn't matter what you make, so long as you're solving problems with both your brain and your hand skills. There is a special part of the brain that becomes engaged when you need to apply intelligence as well as coordination to your hands as they manipulate tools and materials. As Wendell Berry tells us in his poem, The Real Work, it may be that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. When we work in the woodshop, we crave nothing more than new problems to solve. Exercising that part of the intellect and skill set, such as they are, provides a tangible thrill of satisfaction, which is a state to which I hope this audiobook can bring you as well. Now, I am of the opinion that my childhood in rural Illinois played a very important part in my successful development as a practical adult. Left to our own devices, my cousin Ryan and I, along with my neighbor Steve, were free to undertake great adventures in the county's creeks, fields, and forests. This meant riding bicycles and skippering go-karts and building treehouses, complete with armaments with which to protect our fortresses. We made effective slingshots, spears, and swords, but my specialty was the PVC pipe blowgun with poisonous darts of tape and trim nail. Evildoers, sisters, beware. We had to learn mechanical engineering to keep the bikes running and structural architecture to establish our strongholds. We chose the biggest limbed tree down by the creek, scrutinized our pile of wood scraps, and then, with some nails and a hammer, discerned how to apply the wood to the tree in a fashion that would see us comfortably seated at a height over the creek from which we could actually fish. We were problem-solving, for fun back then, but developing a habit that would become a means to very productive lives. Ryan is now a successful farmer and paramedic, and Steve is a successful contractor, and I am a dancing jackass with very nice chisels. You see? Do the math. By the way, I don't think I've ever picked up a tool and used it successfully on the first try, or often even the 20th try. But on that 21st go-round, when I managed to correctly make a shaving cut with a draw knife, well, I feel the very eldritch magic coursing through my musculature and my nifty opposable thumb digits that have allowed us to leave our simian ancestors in the developmental dust. If you're new to woodworking, it's important to understand that you will make mistakes, but that the mistake-making, in a weird way, is the fun part. Pretty much all the woodworkers I know, when talking about this addictive craft, aver their affection for problem-solving. How can I take these 5 rough-sawn maple planks, this bench and these tools, and craft a performance that is part puzzle, part dance, part sculpture, part punching the wall, and part common sense, so that the end result looks an awful lot like a shaker dining table? There are many routes to victory, and of course some paths that will lead to defeat, but I think that with patience and know-how, your winning percentage can always remain quite high. How does woodworking seem to cast a spell over so many initiates? What is woodworking's deal? I think a lot of its allure has to do with the first half of its name, the wood. For many millennia, humankind has been getting its craft on with wood. As a structural or sculptural medium, it has no equal in nature. I mean, stone is amazing and wonderful and pretty, but have you ever tried to chop a mortise in it? Stuff as hard as a rock. I'm also a big fan of steel and bronze and brass and aluminum, the so-called metals. But the use of metals as a medium in fabrication just feels cold to me when compared with wood. Although when I think about what toolmakers like Lee Nielsen Toolworks make with metals for me to use upon wood, I warm right up. Wood, which is found on the inside of trees, has an incredible charisma on many levels. It's strong enough to form the hull of a gigantic sailing ship of the line, like Lord Horatio Nelson's HMS Victory, for example, his British Navy flagship in the 1805 Battle of Trafalgar. Constructed almost entirely of white oak, this heroic tub weighed in at 3,500 tons. If my math is sound, that's 7 million pounds. Because the nations of Earth cannot seem to decide upon one regulated system of measurement, I drew this calculation based upon the weight of American, or short, tons. If indeed the weight corresponds to the ship's country of origin, Great Britain, then we need to tabulate 3,500 imperial, or long, tons for a jaw-dropping total of 7,840,000 pounds. Sigh. Either way, that's some wood with gumption, Gov. Meanwhile, its tensile strength is such that you can steam bend it into knots, allowing one to form a bow back for a Windsor chair or the thin curved sides of a guitar. You can build a wooden lamp and then shave wood thin enough that it can be used as a translucent lampshade as well. It's incredibly versatile and forgiving. We strive for perfection in our work, but when we fall down, wood allows us to cover our tracks with either charm or imperceptibility. There will be plenty more in the coming chapters concerning the correction of errors. The secret to working with wood is to simply understand and love the personality of the wood. Here is the heart of every joinery problem you'll ever encounter. Wood is an organic material, and it will inexorably expand and contract with the humidity in the air, no matter how forcibly you try to keep it from doing so. Trust me, I have learned that particular lesson the very hard way. A great many of the techniques in this book will give you an understanding of how wooden members can be joined together in a sturdy fashion while still allowing for that inevitable movement. That's what makes it like a puzzle. And as we all know, puzzles are the best. I want to encourage you to find the place in your own life where woodworking might fit. That place might be a sweet shop space or a corner of your apartment, your barn, or even out in the woods. I'll talk about different ways to set up a shop in your life and also in your mind, for once you begin to enjoy these different projects, you'll find that an obstinate tinkerer has taken up residence in your body's attic, eyeballing every aspect of your life to see where improvements might be made through the crafting of raw materials. You will find that making things with your hands brings you solace when you're not cussing out a visible glue seam, and better hand-eye coordination, improving your internal health in general, but you can also feel good about the external effect you will have on your world. In the immediate sense, you will be crafting items for your home and/or loved ones, and you'll be occupying your time fruitfully, which is pleasing to both yourself and your parents or spouse. If you're enjoying time in your shop, then you're not out getting into trouble, / eating fast food, / drinking too much beer. Or so I've read. It's simply an organic good time, which my gut tells me has to be healthier than any factory-made diversion. Robert Penn puts it so well in his delectable book, The Man Who Made Things Out of Trees. The pleasure we take from things made from natural materials is an extension of the pleasure we take from nature itself. A community or neighborhood containing citizens who make their own goods is clearly a stronger community, relying upon themselves and one another to thrive instead of sending their wealth outside the area, which serves to buttress instead the strength of foreign producers. Naturally, the same can be said of a nation, and so, by woodworking, you will be doing your part to serve your country as well as your local fellowship. Furthermore, you will be helping our society to do battle against the forces of consumerism that have turned furniture and every other manufactured item into disposable products of fashion. The recent movement of stores like IKEA, for example, has a very slight DIY quality in that their furniture requires the purchaser to assemble the units with an Allen wrench. But don't be fooled. The inferiority of the materials combined with the proliferation of packaging waste makes their transgressions as severe as any cute catalog furniture factory. It all takes up the same space in our overflowing landfills. Given our dwindling natural resources, it seems only decent that we make everything we have the time and means for and imbue our objects with a timeless quality that can serve generations to come. As one good work begets another, so does handcrafting foster its own community of support and education. When you get involved with makers, you invariably begin to rub elbows with the kind of women and men who show up with an unsolicited jar of jam or some leftover meatloaf. Bartering re-enters your daily economy, which also strengthens a neighborhood. Further, I never cease to be amazed at the availability and generosity of makers in clubs and online forums, especially since the advent of the internet, answering the most specialized questions about the most meticulous topics you can imagine. I couldn't run my shop without the fulsome support of the Offerman Woodshop crew. We love to get our heads together on any question, whether it concerns woodworking or animal husbandry or romance, a redundancy in some regions. The shop operates as a co-op, so that each craftsperson sets her or his own production schedule whilst juggling the custom commissions that come in on a regular basis. My invaluable shop manager and our fearless leader, Lee, runs the outfit with pluck, talent, and aplomb, and she is sincerely the first of many heroes you'll hear about in these recordings. We love to solve problems together, all of us, and we love to make each other laugh as well, which happens quite a bit when we get together on a Friday afternoon for a potluck cookout. You'll be invited in to witness all these facets of our lives here, especially since I couldn't have done this book without my teammates in Sawdust. Let's get started.